ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Hi, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I've got more of your favourite stories from Life Matters for this year on our summer specials, and today you're about to get a whole lot of help navigating the ethical minefield of shopping at Christmas time. If your kids are begging you for dupes of popular items, it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, you'll be saving money. On the other, you could be encouraging a trend that rips off smaller designers. How can you manage it? And for the music lover in your life, it's good news. CDs are back, and they're becoming an alternative for people turning away from unethical streaming companies. Plus, if you are looking for a holiday with a bit of a twist, would you consider dark tourism, visiting a place with a dark past? But first, this year, the hugely popular fashion label Princess Polly was awarded B Corp certification. If that name doesn't immediately ring a bell, it is a coveted stamp of approval meant to signal to consumers that a business meets strong social and environmental standards. But here's the catch. Princess Polly has faced a lot of criticism for questionable labour practices, concerning carbon footprint, and a business model built on fast, disposable fashion. So how does a brand that some have labelled ultra-fast fashion manage to score this kind of ethical gold star? And for people who want to shop ethically, what tools do we need to decide where to put our money? Should the industry be held to higher standards? How important is sustainability to you when it comes to your clothes? Do you care where or how your clothes are made? Maybe it feels like a luxury you can't afford at the moment. Well, here to unpick the issue is Claire Press, a fashion sustainability expert, the host of the Wardrobe Crisis podcast, Benny Heenan, who's the co-founder of clothing brand The Common Good Company. They've also been certified by B Corp. And Andrew Davies, the CEO of B Corp's parent company, B Lab. Claire, I'll start with you. Can you explain exactly what B Corp certification is?
Thank you, Tegan. Well, B Corp is a global certification system for responsible business. And in the beginning, some of the most recognisable brands in the sustainability space, the likes of Patagonia, the likes of Ben & Jerry's, were pioneers of this. And if you think about Patagonia, everyone's heard of that outdoor brand. The founder, Yvonne Chouinard, talks about being in business to save the planet. So there's this idea that if you're B Corp accredited, then you must be responsible environmentally and socially and best practice. And look, I'll just finish up by saying, I think to some extent that is true. This is a robust accreditation system. I know we've got someone on the call from B Lab, but you do have to jump through a bunch of hoops in order to reach accreditation. It's not simple and it is serious.
So how did you react when you saw that Princess Polly was certified?
Well, herein lies the rub, okay? So my background's in fashion journalism, but I'm in my late 40s and I'm not a Princess Polly customer. And I'm going to confess that I actually wasn't across this brand at all until this controversy. But Princess Polly is a really quite a substantial fast fashion brand. They started in Australia. They were founded in 2010 in the Gold Coast. They're now American-based. But they've got a really high turnover. They've got 2.1 or something, I think, a million followers on Instagram. And they're producing clothes at volume at a fast pace. So the question that people in sustainability circles are asking is, can you be environmentally, in particular, environmentally responsible, if you're churning out huge numbers of styles, and if volume is a problem? I'll just say that I checked the website and there are 867 styles of dresses available on that website right now.
And so just to kind of unpack that a bit, the problem there is that the business model is sort of based on volume and consumption, which is sort of at odds with the idea of of having a lighter footprint?
Absolutely. So we globally were producing something like, and it's hard to even pin this down because there's not enough transparency in brands and in the system, but something like 150 billion garments every year. We are drastically overproducing clothing across all categories. And when we look specifically at fast fashion and now ultra fast fashion, so even faster, this is a problem. It's very difficult to argue that you're sustainable if you are overproducing.
Well, we've been talking about the certification. Let's hear from the certifier. Andrew Davies is the CEO of B Corp's parent company, B Lab. Andrew, I know you didn't personally give this brand the tick, but what would have gone into this certification?
Thanks, Tegan. And I appreciate the earlier answer there. It's a fair capture of what we do. The reality is that we look at the entirety of a business. So we're not just a certification for a product or for a particular attribute, like an organic or fair trade certification, which play really important parts in the system of sustainability as well. But we look at the whole business. And the bit that's not as well known is there are some fundamental requirements that all B Corp sign up to. And that's a commitment to accountability and transparency. And you actually have to bake into your company's sort of legal foundational documents, a commitment to engage stakeholders and operate to a public benefit purpose. And I know that sounds a little bit wonky, and maybe the lawyers out there get excited by it, but not many others. But the reality is that's a really important part of what we do. The kind of source code error in our capitalist system is that we all assume businesses simply operate for the benefit of shareholders. And that's the dominant sort of paradigm that we've been operating in for the last 50 years. A key part of B Corp certification challenges that and asks business and tasks businesses with looking to solve the problems of the commons. And I think that what Princess Polly has done here is taken on that commitment and that obligation to accountability and transparency that puts it at a disadvantage to its competitors, but gives me hope that some of those more challenging business models of fast fashion, which have the potential to reduce waste through responding to demand, but most often do stimulate demand and create that overconsumption. Well, if we've got a player in that sector that's willing to be accountable to create change, I think that's a net positive. And that's the part of B Corp certification that's perhaps not as well known, but I think is a really important part of the mix.
Sure. So there's a whole lot of different criteria. We're maybe focusing on one segment of that and you're saying, look at the whole thing. But for a company that their whole business model is about churning out a lot of product, how is that not fundamentally incompatible with B Corp's values?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, but I also accept that scale is incredibly hard to grapple with. When we think of sustainable businesses, it's easiest to recognise them as the kind of small innovators who design really unique products, and businesses like Benny's Common Good Company that have gone out of the way to create 100% recycled fabrics, or businesses like Citizen Wolf in Sydney who have a model to create bespoke T-shirts to completely eliminate waste, or Outland Denim who directly employ seamstresses in Southeast Asia to sort of tackle modern slavery in really innovative ways. Those businesses look and feel more directly sustainable. And when we operate at scale, it does feel uncomfortable. But the reality is that those high innovative businesses struggle to reach that scale. And so we need to bridge that gap. And I think that the connection between some of these really highly innovative fashion businesses and the larger ones, those connections that we make within the B Corp community, are going to be part of solving some of the problems that the entire fashion industry has to reckon with. And I think that idea of fast fashion is something that the fashion industry needs to deal with. How can you harness those benefits of being more responsive to demand and reducing waste, but avoiding that overconsumption? That's also a conversation we need to have as consumers. You know, there is a huge drive for people to have new shiny things that is sometimes at odds with the idea of being sustainable. But you can't ignore that. And the businesses of the future that are going to solve those problems are not the ones that sit on the sidelines and wait for others to solve the problems. They're not the ones that are going to wait for government to just regulate away the sort of side effects of these business models. They're the businesses that lean in and say, hey, we need to be part of the solution and we need to be accountable.
Mm. I mean, we are talking specifically about Princess Polly today, but almost as a symbol of fast fashion writ large. We did reach out to Princess Polly for comment. They declined to participate in the interview, but they offered a statement that included in part many of the initiatives that contributed to Princess Polly's B Corp score was already integrated as our way of working prior to the beginning of the certification process, rather rather than implementing entirely new practices, the focus was on formalising, documenting and verifying these existing efforts to meet B Corp's rigorous standards. Princess Polly achieved a score of 86.8 against the B Corp requirement of 80 points and the industry standard of 50.9. I'll put the whole version of that statement on the Life Matters website, because you are listening to Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking about whether fast fashion is inherently at odds with the idea of sustainability in the wake of this brand, Princess Polly, being awarded B Corp certification. You just heard from the CEO of B Corp's parent company, Andrew Davies. And I'm asking you how important sustainability is when it comes to your clothes. Ali says, to reduce fabric waste, I've committed to buying only secondhand clothes. It's been great so far. I'll also swap clothes with friends and family or repair. I haven't purchased underwear yet, but would buy this new or repair the elastic. Another person says, sustainability, except for underwear and socks, buy secondhand. I guess if you're looking at starting a sustainable undies business, that would be a good place to start. With me is the co-founder of sustainable clothing company Common Good, Benny Heenan. Benny, your company has a score of 110 on the B Corp scale. Hearing that a fast fashion company has the same certification as you, what's your reaction there?
It's a little bit disillusioned. And I go back to the start of the year when, and we're actually at a forum, a sustainable fashion forum in Sydney, which Claire actually was the chair of. And my wife and I heard about Princess Polly potentially coming B Corp then, and we were dumbfounded. And then obviously the announcement came through, you know, discussing it more with my wife and co-founder. I guess one of the things that we look at as part of being more broadly the B Corp community, and Claire mentioned some of the biggest heavy hitters in Patagonia and Ben & Jerry's at the initial one, and then we heard about some fantastic Australian brands like Basique and Outland Denim, Booty, who I'd recommend to your previous caller, who was
the undies.
B Corp. Yeah, B Corp one. All of these businesses, and we talk about B Corp being beneficial, they're purposeful. There is, for us, there is nothing purposeful about a Princess Polly. So that alignment with that B Corp, and this has been the word sustainability in fashion, which doesn't exist. It's an oxymoron. Like, we don't prescribe to be sustainable. We are responsible. And we also don't prescribe to be in fashion. We work in apparel. Like, we don't do seasonal drops. Only in the last 18 months, we introduced some colours into our range. We're primarily black and white. So to hear about a brand that produces 150 new items a week can then be termed and use this coin of sustainability, which is then backed up by a B Corp certification, to us, it just sounds like a greenwash.
Do you not take Andrew's point, though, that the big picture, that it's part of a commitment to improving?
Oh, I definitely. But there's a baseline of improvement. And then if we look at around like the B-Lab score, and we welcome the new certifications and new standards that have just been introduced. Princess Polly has gained certification on the old standards, the new standards, and Andrew will talk about this a lot more articulately and knowledgeably than what I will. But the new standards that have been introduced will, again, make it harder for the certification. And I as a B Corp, I welcome that new certification to come in, and I guess look at the things that Princess Polly are doing in this space, and I just think that just should be the standard of what every business should do. So I guess whilst we welcome Princess Polly, who are essentially, you know, Australian Sheen, I don't also think that anything that they do in the space is sustainable. Mm-hmm. And then to use that and then B Corp for primarily a 16 to 25-year-old age bracket, I don't think is responsible.
Andrew, does it concern you that other businesses with your certification are worried that it's being devalued?
Oh, I mean, naturally, yes, it does. But I also welcome the debate. I mean, I think that what's one of the really incredible parts of the B Corp community is that what good looks like in this space is being constantly changing, and it's often hotly contested. And I think the reality is that we've seen some of the earliest adopters of the B Corp standard were those known innovators in this space, those businesses that had a really strong track record for driving change. And those businesses that have been created, like Benny's, with a very specific problem in mind. And I think that's what's really exciting about much of the B Corp community is that they are businesses that are being created to solve the problems of the commons. But we are also seeing legacy older businesses with some of those business models seek to change themselves as well. And that is the tension that we hold. We accept that there are going to be those businesses that find this challenging. But if we don't enable other businesses at scale to change, then we're also not going to meet some of those larger challenges. I would love people to absolutely put a rocket under businesses like Benny's, like Booty, like Underwear for Humanity is another great one for that underwear problem. Mm-hmm. You know, those sort of businesses really are presenting incredible solutions, but they struggle to reach scale. And there is an important conversation about changing consumer behaviours. And Princess Polly has a megaphone. They have a huge opportunity to drive change. So what I'm excited about is the opportunity for Princess Polly to influence change. But of course, I recognise it creates tension for some of those innovators and early adopters in the B Corp community who find this challenging. But I think that comes back to that question of community. I mean, one of the things that's a little unusual about what we do is we really encourage collaboration amongst our business community. The traditional idea of business as simply competing and trying to be the best at what they do has been turned on its head in sustainability circles, where so many businesses are openly sharing their solutions to some of these wicked problems. And that, to me, is where the fashion industry is going to drive change at scale, is when there's a high degree of collaboration.
Claire, I'm sort of hearing this conversation and we're hearing about the need for accreditation and the different kind of metrics that we can be measured against and old criteria and new criteria. And it all feels like it's very much in the service of trying to do the best we possibly can from the business point of view.
Yeah.
Amazing. But for consumers, it is hugely consuming.
Concerning.
Confusing. I can't even get the word out.
Look, and I'm concerned about... Why is the conversation all about scale? Now, I do recognise that change at scale changes the world, but at the same time, my view would be that we need lots of small brands doing exemplary work and we need to push our focus onto them. And this idea of fast fashion's ability to be sustainable, I think, is inherently flawed. I think we've got a problem if we are broadly looking at ultra-fast fashion as a business model and saying, if you just use a bit more preferred fibres, for example, if you're using more recycled polyester rather than virgin, if you're considering plugging in a bit of organic cotton, we're going to give you a tick and say, well done, you're sustainable. You're still highly polluting in terms of the volumes that you're churning out. You're still driving this obsession with newness, with trend-based product. And I don't think it's fair to push this onto the consumer. It is not down to the consumer to police businesses. It's businesses that are profiting from this. It's businesses that have the responsibility. And in the absence of legislation forcing them to do better, to take ethics, living wages, and volumes, production volumes, into consideration, then they've got to do it. It's not down to the shopper to hold the brands accountable. And I know I sound a bit stroppy, but it sort of makes me feel a bit stroppy because I think we're giving them a free pass. And I do believe in the B Corp movement. I think it's a fantastic framework, actually. So let's not pile on B Corp and say that they're not doing a great job. They are doing a great job. But more broadly, we've got a problem with the rampant consumerism that underpins our culture and with fast fashion brands growing exponentially and with pollution growing as a result.
Thank you all for sharing your wisdom today. There's a lot of food for thought as you work your way through the mad rush to buy gifts these holidays. Claire Press is a fashion sustainability expert. She's the host of the Wardrobe Crisis podcast. Benny Heenan is the co-founder of clothing brand The Common Good Company. They've also been certified by B Corp. And Andrew Davies is the CEO of B Corp's parent company, B Lab. And that full Princess Polly statement is on our website for you to read as well. A lot of op shoppers on the text line. Dave says, I absolutely care what clothes I buy, as much natural fibre as possible. Dean says, op shops are the first place I go for myself and my son. Another texter says, Sustainability and workers' rights are very important to me. I'm fortunate enough to be able to pay for this, and my style isn't related to fast fashion. I think it's important to differentiate between want and need. Fast fashion is largely about want. Such an important point there about the bigger picture. It's humans driving the demand for fast fashion. And up next, one of the trends behind cheap buys, it's dupe culture. Have you heard of it? That's up next.
Hey, it's Anthony Burke here. Radio National presents The Homefront. Housing in Australia is under pressure. The crisis is real. But could better design be part of the fix? I'm Anthony Burke, and in The Homefront, we explore how the great Australian dream is shifting and what we could do to build a better future. To hear The Homefront, search Radio National Presents on the ABC Listen app.
How important is it to you to look fashionable, even expensive? Even if you're not much of a fashionista, you might have noticed that dupe culture, dupes as in duplicates, is on the rise. Earlier this year, annual sales on the fast fashion platform Shein, which is known for selling super affordable knockoffs of high-end fashion brands, topped $1 billion in Australia for the first time. And that's just one platform. Competitors like Temu, Wish, and AliExpress also offer cheaper version of brand name products, as do big chain stores. Counterfeit fashion is nothing new. No, I'm not the only one that remembers the fake Louis Vuitton handbags that all the Bali tourists brought home maybe 10 or 15 years ago. But these days, people aren't hiding the fact that they're knockoffs. They're flaunting it. So why have shoppers embraced dupes? And how has dupe culture impacted local designers and business owners who find their creations copied without their permission? Tell me, have you bought a dupe? What is the appeal of a dupe to you? Or are you an artist or creator who's had their designs copied without permission? Well, with me is Dr. Taylor Bridges, a researcher at the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology, Sydney, and Christian Williams, a Brisbane-based fashion designer. Taylor, I'll start with you. How have dupes become such a dominant trend?
It's been really a combination of factors that we've seen in recent years. Of course, there's the cost of living crisis that we're in, so we all have less money to spend. And kind of looking at your last segment, really the rise of social media is a huge part of that as well. We're living online. We want to present a certain image online, so being able to be a part of that and look a certain way. We're also seeing that luxury brands have also gone up in price. So, well, of course, we were seeing over the last 50 years, actually, it was around a 5 to 7% increase annually of luxury goods. Some data from HSBC suggested that between 2020 and late 2024, luxury brands actually went up 54% on average. So those luxury products have increasingly become out of reach for so many of us, and that the dupes or those alternatives are becoming increasingly seen as a savvy way to shop.
Yeah, what's the difference between a dupe and a counterfeit item?
Yeah, it's a great question. So a dupe is essentially a lookalike. So it's mimicking a style or design of a luxury or branded item, but without using any of those logos or trademarks. You'll hear this a lot. It's about capturing the vibe of an original, and it's not pretending to be it. So similar shapes, colors, or styles, but they're not claiming to be the real thing. Where the counterfeits, like you mentioned, they are made to deceive. It's copying branding. It's trying to pass itself off as an original. And with dupes, you're really saying, hey, this gives you that same look for less, where counterfeit is trying to say this is the real thing, even when it's not.
There used to be a real social stigma around buying a fake, and it sounds like there's a bit of a distinction here. But what is it about this moment that makes dupes kind of like almost as trendy as having the real designer deal?
Yeah, I think that counterfeits or knockoffs really had that really negative connotation of being shameful or that dirty secret, where, like you said, dupes are really being embraced as smart shopping. And a part of that is this rejection of these rising luxury prices, where also at the same time that the quality, there's perceptions that the quality of luxury goods have gone down as well. So a dupe is offering you a more affordable access to that style, really for a fraction of the cost, and again, against this broader cost of living crisis that we're in.
Christian, I want to turn to you. For people who aren't familiar with your brand, it's really art base.
Very much, yes.
And you were seeing copies of your clothing being sold online.
I did, yeah. So I think it was about this time last year. It was brought to my attention by customers, believe it or not, on social media, and they said, your caftan is being knocked off and there's this website that is selling them and they're selling them for like $90. And I was beyond like horrified because, you know, that's your intellectual property. And the more I looked into it, the more that I realised how many websites were actually copying this particular caftan and then using all my imagery and also using social media videos and stuff that they had reposted and then used on social media for advertising.
So they're not even copying your designs on their socials. They're literally using your actual images.
They're actually using my intellectual property. And, you know, friends of mine who have done me a favour, like Brooke Falvey, she's an influencer here in Brisbane, and she did a favour for me by doing a video try-on of one of my caftans, and they have gone ahead and reposted that, and they are selling so many of them, and people are falling prey to this all the time.
How does this, I mean, it feels self-evident, but talk to me about the realities of what that means for your business.
Well, what it means for me is that, you know, it's cheapening what I do, I suppose, but having said that, these are really bad fakes, like really, really, really bad. Like we're talking 100% polyester, really bad sequin work. Print isn't always accurate, but, you know, I just feel for all these people that are falling for it, you know, because it looks so real.
Because they're using your image.
Exactly.
So, Taylor, what's the difference between someone sort of taking Christian's designs, a smaller than say a big house like Hermes or Chanel, and knocking that off as opposed to the big global brands?
Oh, it's heartbreaking because you think about the amount of work that people like Christian are putting into their designs, and then for you to just to see in a matter of minutes, it feels like sometimes to have that dupe online. It really comes down to enforcement, because you might have for like a bigger brand being able to decide to actually take on legal action, or if we saw the example with Uniqlo that their Mary Poppins bag was knocked off and they were able to file legal action against Shein. But it often really comes down to these issues around enforcement. And it is so hard, particularly when these brands or the counterfeits and the knockoffs are operating across international borders. If you have platforms like Temu or Shein, they're operating within layers of third-party sellers. So it gets really difficult to pin down actually who is responsible for it. And really, when that legal action is so expensive, and you're going against a massive platform with deep pockets and that fast turnaround, it really leaves you in a really difficult position.
Christian, what message do you want to share with consumers?
Look, I just think, I know that, you know, there's a cost of living crisis at the moment. You know, things are going up and, you know, people to spend $700 on a dress, it's a lot of money and I understand that. But you've got to think about the creatives that are producing these, like myself. I spend hours and hours and hours a day designing and coming up with concepts, like new concepts, with my mother who designs with me. And to see that then just blasted out into the stratosphere of social media and online, it's heartbreaking. So just be a little bit more cautious when you're buying, and maybe try and do a little bit more research, maybe reverse image search. If it seems too good to be true and it's really cheap, try and do something like that, because you're not only buying a fake product, but you're going to get a really, really bad product as well.
On the text line, Peter in Geelong says, dupes still sound like counterfeits just being legitimised. Intellectual property is still being ripped off. Well, thank you so much, Christian Williams, Brisbane-based fashion designer, and Dr. Taylor Bridges, a researcher at the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology, Sydney. And if you're looking at spiralling budget for gifts at the moment, you're about to hear about how the cheaper way to listen to music on an old-fashioned CD is making a comeback and becoming an alternative for people turning away from unethical streaming services. These days, we have pretty much the entire world's music, movies, and television shows at our fingertips. But would you be willing to ditch this convenience if it meant paying artists fairly? It's a question more and more music lovers are wrestling with, especially when it comes to one streaming giant in particular. There has been outrage over the Spotify CEO's perceived ethical failings, not to mention dwindling funds flowing to artists. A large number of high-profile artists have ditched the platform and taken their music with them. But is temporary outrage enough to turn people off streaming totally and turn them back into the concept of owning art? Tell me, if you're part of this move away from streaming, are you rebuilding your library of vinyl, CDs and MP3s that you own outright instead? And here to chat about it with me is Steve Bell. He runs an independent record store in Brisbane and an indie music label. And Dr. Ben Green, who is a music sociologist from RMIT University. Ben, what's behind this round of artists pulling their music off Spotify?
Well, Tegan, I think it was summed up very well by the singer-songwriter David Bridie the other day. Some listeners might remember him from My Friend the Chocolate Cake. And he wrote in The Guardian, Spotify used to seem like a necessary evil for musicians. Now it just seems evil. Oh. So what he's talking about there is that the sort of necessary evil is that for its whole life, Spotify has been the leader of the streaming model of music. And under that model, we're all quite aware that musicians don't, for the most part, see much income from their recordings. And we've realised that Australian and especially new artists are struggling to cut through to audiences on those platforms. So there is this simmering resentment against this model of streaming that Spotify really is the face of. But occasionally this boils over. And the recent trigger is that, as you mentioned, the Spotify CEO, Daniel Ek, he leads an investment firm that's invested $1 billion in weapons technology like AI weapons and drones, just at a time when we're all seeing this kind of tech used in atrocities. And so my sense is that musicians are thinking, I've endured this system, someone else is making money and I'm not, but if that's the case, why should I let my work be used to fund something that I'm actually morally opposed to?
So that's a very specific example with one streamer. Does it mean it's all rosy on all the other platforms?
Well, short answer, no. I think it's significant that musicians and fans are looking behind the curtain more and taking an interest in who owns things and the flows of money behind things in the music business. There's this new level of economic literacy, you could say. And if you're so inclined, then you do some Googling about music streaming platforms. By the way, Google's very much bound up in the same flows of money. You find it's pretty hard to keep clean. And the reason is that these platforms tend to be in that tech investment world, and they're owned at least partly by the same global private equity firms that are investing in weapons or colonialism or carbon emissions and so on. I should say one platform that is generally regarded as more ethical, especially on artist payments, is Bandcamp. But that's more like an online shopfront where artists place their music. But even they had a controversy a few years ago when they got bought out by a games company and there was concern about their labour dealings.
So, Steve, you've got an indie label as well as owning a record store here in Brisbane. Are there artists on your label considering leaving streaming services?
I have had a couple already that have spoken to me about, just in a preliminary manner, about the realities of removing their music because they're seeing some of their peers and contemporaries doing it and are pretty keen to follow suit. Like Ben just said, it's pretty much, this weapons saga is almost the straw that broke the camel's back rather than the sort of crux of the issue. There's been all these issues such as, you know, AI music and ghost artists and the way that the algorithms are being set up to sort of deprive artists of the income, the measly income that they're already getting. And, you know, the music industry is generating as much money now today as it was in its 90s heyday, but now that money is getting siphoned off to the tech sector rather than going back to labels and musicians. And everyone's a bit sick of it. And, yeah, this has just been a convenient point that's got everyone sort of tipped over, I think.
That's so interesting that you say that it's the money's still coming in that way. I think that's not a story that we hear very often. Ben, can we put some figures around, if you're not an artist, you probably don't know, how much Amuso is getting for a stream?
Yes, well, so streaming platforms, they don't pay a fixed rate per stream. What they do is each month they tally up all their revenue from the subscriptions and the ads, and there's a portion that then they divide up according to how many streams each rights holder had. So the rights holder might be a record label or an artist if they're independent. But we do get to see the averages that are paid out, and Spotify is usually near the bottom of that list, partly because they have the most streams, and that's half a cent or less per stream usually. So 1,000 streams equals $5.
Yeah.
Their competitor Tidal, famously started by Jay-Z, the rapper, markets itself as the highest, and they generally are. That's a bit more than 1 cent per stream, and that's partly because they're subscription only and they charge more. And Apple's in between, Amazon's in between, close to Spotify. The thing is, these cents are paid to the rights holder, which, as I said, that's often a record label. And as we know from last century, that the artist might only see a fraction of the money their label takes in, depending on their contract and their debts and things. And as we know, there's all sorts of labels, big and small.
But isn't that kind of just the business model, right? You've got this massive platform. It's a volume game. You're putting out as much as possible. Steve, like, what would be a fairer way of doing this?
Look, it's hard to say in this new digital age what an equitable system would look like, but just the reality is that the one that we've got at the moment is just completely unfair and rigged towards the tech companies. And I mean, the reality is if we keep depriving artists of income and opportunity to actually forge a career, then music's only going to be an option for people who are already independently wealthy. And if you put barriers on art, that's just, it's awful for humanity, just about, you know, like, we need to let people build a career if they want. And there's just too many barriers at the moment.
I should say we did reach out to Spotify for comment. They didn't provide a statement, but they directed us to their website, which says exactly when and how much artists and songwriters get paid depends on their agreements with their record labels and distributors. As Ben mentioned before, Spotify makes payments to rights holders who pay this to artists according to their own individual agreements with the artists. And according to Spotify's Loud and Clear webpage, Spotify paid $10 billion to the music industry in 2024, saying it's the highest paying retailer globally. You are here on Life Matters on Radio National with me, Tegan Taylor, talking to Steve Bell, who runs an independent record store in Brisbane and an indie music label, and Dr. Ben Green, a music sociologist from RMIT University. And I've been asking whether you're turning away from streaming and rebuilding your library of owned media. Matthew says, I never stop purchasing physical media because I don't want a streaming corporation determining what I can and cannot watch. I also purchase digital media, so I own the digital download for the same reason. Matthew says, I've got a wonderful collection of Blu-rays, DVDs, CDs and vinyls. Friends laughed at me at first. Now they're seeing the wisdom as their favourites are eliminated from streaming libraries. Those DVDs they threw away are now sorely missed. Another says, never got rid of my vinyl or CDs. We've got young musicians in the family. They alerted me to the streaming model that is so dodgy. Thank goodness for the young generation. Steve, in your record store, are you seeing an uptick? Are you seeing this kind of translating into people coming in and buying more physical media?
Definitely. And it's been happening for probably the best part of a decade now, especially, you know, with the vinyl revival. But every day I get people coming in asking questions about turntables and the realities of buying music because they're just setting out on their vinyl voyage. People are turning to it. It's aspirational now. You see it in a lot of movies and what have you. The interesting one that I've noticed, and I know this is happening anecdotally from friends in the States as well, is that younger music lovers are turning to CDs at the moment. Physical media is still aspirational for them too. They want to get into it. They realise that the art, having the artwork and the lyrics and the better sound is all positive. But, you know, the turntables are quite expensive and vinyl is getting quite expensive, unfortunately. So CDs are a cost-effective entry point, and they're filling their boots with cheap CDs at the moment, same as people were doing with records probably 20 years ago.
So, Ben, do you think this is sort of a flash in the pan with a bit of outrage now, or do you think this is the start of a true shift?
Well, personally, you know, I know a handful of people who have switched off Spotify in recent weeks, but, you know, in context, Spotify's got 700 million listeners worldwide. Only about a third of that actually subscribe. The rest put up with the ads. Mm. Apple's got about 100 million. Tidal's got about 20 million. So a few people, you know, might not make that much of a dent. But I do know that, as Steve was just saying, there's a lot of people out there who want to invest in the artists they like, and they're looking for a place to put their money. There are people that do like to own things and to feel a part of things. The industry at the moment, speaking of investment, Goldman Sachs just put out a report about the superfan who wants to spend up big on their favourite artist, and the industry is excited about this person. They buy box sets and they buy the VIP tickets, and people are fatigued with the streaming. You know, some of that convenience, it's all about convenience, and when the convenience starts to go, then you question the other things. But I guess it's about platforms are kind of good at music as a functional thing and music as a background. But as we know, that's not all music is. It's also a physical pleasure. It's about your identity. It's about feeling a part of something and connected to something. And I can't see that going away.
Well, thank you both for joining me on my favourite streaming alternative, radio. Steve Bell runs an independent record store in Brisbane and an indie music label. Dr. Ben Green is a music sociologist from RMIT University. You've been hearing stories about consuming more ethically in this summer special of Life Matters. And I know for me, if I don't know what gift to buy someone, I just head straight to my local bookshop, because who doesn't love a good book? So if you're looking for recommendations, we asked some of your favourite Australians about the book that changed their life. And for Australian Story host Lee Sales, it's a book she read in grade one and it changed her life forever.
Hello, I'm Lee Sales. I'm the anchor of Australian Story and The Assembly. And the book that changed my life is The Enchanted Wood by Enid Blyton. The Enchanted Wood is a story about three young English children who go into a wood and they find this gigantic tree, and it turns out to be the magic faraway tree, and there are all these magical people who live in the tree. And when you climb to the top of the tree, you go through this hole into the clouds, and there are magical lands that are up there and they rotate all the time, and you're never quite sure what you're going to find up there. Some of the lands are great, like the land of goodies, which is all full of sweets and lollies, and some of them are terrible, like the land of smacks, where you get smacked all the time. I was in grade one when I first read this book, and the reason I read it and why it changed my life is because I was often unwell when I was in grade one. I was a kid who didn't go to kindergarten or preschool. I just started school when I was 6 years old in grade one. And that meant I had not been, other than around my brother, I hadn't been around big groups of children, which meant that I got absolutely every bug that was going once I was in a big cohort of kids. And so I had to have lots of time sick from school. And my teacher said to my mother, to keep her engaged, maybe you could get her reading. And my mother came home one day and she had this book. And I absolutely loved it, and really it was the key to setting me on a lifetime love of reading. I think the thing that was so evocative for me in The Enchanted Wood was that it was just such a rich work of imagination, and it really transported you to an entirely different world. I mean, I grew up in suburban Brisbane, on the outskirts of suburban Brisbane. And then here was this world where they were, you know, traipsing through the woods in England and, you know, through the bracken and the heather. And it was just such a totally different world. And then the idea of all these magical people who lived in the tree, I was forever roaming around, you know, bald hills looking at gum trees and wondering if that could be the magic faraway tree. And it was just so completely transporting. And I think it's something I still love about books, that they can just take you to a totally different world. I always talk about The Enchanted Wood when people ask me about, you know, the book that changed my life or the most influential book, because as I say, it just got me on a lifetime of reading. My boys have not really had any interest in it. I suspect that the book that fulfills the same position in contemporary children's reading lives is probably Harry Potter, because it's the same notion of this richly imagined world, and it probably feels more contemporary to them than some of the references in The Enchanted Wood, which now, you know, is a very old book. So no, sadly, I have not been able to pass the love of that onto my Philistine children. I'm Lee Sales, and that was The Book That Changed My Life.
That was Australian Story host Lee Sales on The Book That Changed Her Life, Enid Blyton's The Enchanted Wood. Well, next, have you got holidays coming up? Maybe somewhere tropical, a bit of beach time in the sun, but some people are exploring the darker side of the world. It's a name synonymous with tragedy. Jonestown was sold to followers as a utopian paradise until one day in 1978, more than 900 people drank cyanide-laced punch under the command of cult leader Jim Jones. The world was horrified. It was at the time the single greatest loss of life due to a deliberate civilian act in American history. Now, almost 50 years later, Jonestown is open for business as a tourist destination. Dark tourism isn't a new phenomenon. For a long time, we've been fascinated by places defined by death, disaster, and grief. So when is it okay, and when is it a bit icky? Tell me if you've been a dark tourist. I'd love to know your motives and maybe where you went. Dr. Carolyn Mackay is co-director of the Sydney Institute of Criminology at Sydney University. She researches dark tourism and even says she has been a dark tourist herself. Carolyn, where have you been that we would consider a dark tourism site?
Good morning, Tegan. I've been to many dark tourist sites. So within Australia, I've been to Port Arthur, various former jails like Old Maitland Jail, Berrima Jail. I've been to sites of massacre in far north Queensland, for example, up near Yungaburra. Internationally, I've been to various sites in Cambodia, Vietnam, Japan, places in England like, you know, old the London Tower and places like that, Highgate Cemetery in the States, Alcatraz, Ground Zero. But I also do a bit of dark tourism for my actual research by looking at crimes in motel rooms.
Right. Okay, so a lot of this is related to your work, but when you hear that people want to go to Jonestown, how does that sit for you?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one because this was the site it was a murder-suicide. It wasn't just a suicide, it was a murder-suicide. And of course, we know that, you know, approximately 300 children died at the hands very often of their parents in that situation. So it is, a particularly terrible site. And I guess it depends on how, on the context of the actual tours that go there. Are they setting it up as a tourist attraction, as I've read online, that people are sort of seeing it in the context of an attraction, which seems quite unethical and quite disrespectful both to the victims of that murder-suicide as well as, you know, the other people who have been touched by that, the, you know, survivors and the victims' family members as well. So I guess it really depends on how it's packaged. Is it going to be basically a commodification of death and, you know, a commercialization of that? Or is it going to be done in a way that is a little bit more educational, that can actually throw some light on perhaps how we can identify an emerging cult and prevent it from ever happening again?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the list that you said. I'm thinking about places that I've been. I've been to the catacombs in Paris and, yeah, convict sites and ghost tours in Australia. Is it a time-elapsing thing that makes those places feel okay, or is it something about the nature of the crime that
that means that there's a reverence to how we approach it?
I think it's really hard to control how people engage with these sites when, you know, whether there's a reverence or not to them, I guess comes down to a couple of factors. First of all, how it is presented. So how do the tour guides, if there are tour guides, or how do they discuss it? Are they talking about it with giving dignity to the victims of those particular sites, or are they sort of doing it in a sensationalist kind of voyeuristic way? What information is actually provided in those sites that actually give, again, context in a dignified manner, in a respectful manner that can sort of garner our empathy and compassion rather than our, you know, ghoulishness, I guess. But it also comes down to people's motivations in going to these sites. Why are we going there? Are we going there to learn? Are we going there to kind of ogle? How do we act when we actually are on these sites, knowing that, you know, many people who are near these sites, especially if they are in recent history, for example, like in Cambodia, how do we navigate those sites and talk to people in a sensitive manner?
Phil on the text line says, I visited Dachau and the Wannsee House where the decisions on the final solution were taken in 1942, and says, I don't know if that's dark tourism or historical curiosity. Carolyn, is there a line here? Does it all fall into one big bucket?
I think there's different forms of dark tourism. I think, you know, for example, going to a Holocaust site is probably a particular form of tourism, and we know that that's very much connected to people's heritage and identity, and knowing that, you know, there's intergenerational trauma that has arisen from those particular sites. But there's other types of tourism, dark tourism. There's, for example, going to places like Pompeii, a very ancient site of natural disaster. There's also poverty tourism, which would probably fall, you know, loosely under the umbrella of dark tourism. So, for example, there's people wanting to go to Brazil and wander around the favelas to, again, perhaps ogle at people's private situations there, which it seems incredibly unethical. And then we also have, you know, war tourism. Of course, how many Australians go to Anzac Cove every year? That is also a form of dark tourism.
Do you think that our obsession with true crime at the moment is fueling some of this curiosity?
Oh, look, I think so, for sure. I think that there are certain sites, and as I mentioned, Port Arthur, well, has a long convict site, but of course the more recent massacre that occurred there as well, there is a level of interest in those sorts of places once they're actually named in criminal offending. Of course, most recently we can see the mushroom case down in Victoria, Snowtown murders as well. A lot of these cases have actually put these places on the map, and they're often been places that no one would have ever heard of.
Briefly, if people want to be respectful in engaging with these places, how do they approach it?
I think you can be respectful in visiting these places, and I guess I would encourage people to be informed about what they're going to see, try and, you know, educate themselves beforehand as to what's gone on, what might be the ongoing impacts in that particular community, so that they're hopefully making a decision to go there that's not going to intensify the suffering of any victims' families that might still be living in that particular area. Mm. I think to think before you open your mouth and ask a question of someone in that area, think about the sensitivities. Perhaps think about, well, if someone was coming to visit the site of the death or injury of a family member of my own, how would I feel about it? And what sort of questions would I be happy to discuss, and what sort of things would I not be happy to discuss?
Excellent advice in case you're off to a dark tourism adventure this summer holidays. Thank you, Dr. Carolyn Mackay, co-director of the Sydney Institute of Criminology at Sydney University.
On ABC Radio National,
the arts aren't just entertainment.
They're part of who
we are.
Andy Griffiths.
He ended up at the centre of the earth fighting the peanut butter beast.
Now, Ben O'Cree.
Put their hands up if they have never been brokenhearted.
The changing nature of performance and recording in Australia.
From books to music and far beyond, the arts are just one way Radio National explores the world in full.
Well, that is it for today on Life Matters. And if that last story has you thinking about taking a holiday, tomorrow on the show, we're talking about work-life balance and how you can build it into your everyday. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.